All right, Mary. Well, we are now officially recording. Welcome to Talk Mental Health with Logan Noon.
All right. Thanks so much for having me, Logan.
Yeah, no, I'm really excited to get to know you. I know you, quite frankly, I guess through your Instagram page, so_bipolar. And I followed your page for a long time. You know, I've always known about your page, to be honest, and we just have never really connected one-on-one like this. But then the other day I saw that video you posted about the story of your son, and I was so compelled to message you and get you on this podcast. Can you share that story for the listeners?
Yes. So my son, who is in sixth grade, middle school, he was in his health class. I was asking him about what's going on in school, and he was showing me his notebook and showing me how they're learning how to care for their emotional health, their physical health, and their mental health. So of course, as being somebody who's very vocal with her mental health, I asked him, well, have they brought up bipolar yet? Hoping in a way that they had, because I think that the sooner kids learn about it, the better. And he said, actually, Mom, they did. And I raised my hand in class and I said, I know all about bipolar because my mom has it. And I seriously, like, I had the biggest, most proudest smile. I wish I could have like captured that moment, because I've been working so hard to instill in my kids that bipolar is not the dirty word that a lot of people make it out to be, and not something to be ashamed of. So when he said with pride, my mom has bipolar in front of all of his classmates, I was just so proud and just so encouraged to see that, you know, that 1% at a time, even just my son, is slowly, I mean, the people he meets in his life are going to also learn from his example that bipolar and other mental health conditions are not something to be ashamed of. So yeah. I felt that was very encouraging.
I mean, I just think it's such a powerful message, and it shows that that work that all of us advocates do, it really can have an impact. And I think one of the most effective and efficient ways to alleviate stigma is starting with the next generation. And the fact that, you know, your son, or he's, I imagine, 11 or 12 or whatever, you know, his attitude towards stigma, and sounds like his class and his teacher was, you know, very receptive to that, has a totally different opinion of mental illness than you know, our elders. You know, it's radically, radically different.
Yes. Yes. Because even when I was little, I remember one time hearing the word bipolar come out of my mother's mouth, because my mother also has bipolar, as did my grandma and many other relatives. But I remember hearing that and I said, Mom, what is that? Like, what is that all about? Because it was a very serious conversation. She was like, oh, never mind. That's not something you need to know about, you know? Mm-hmm. And that was that, through no fault of my mother, you know, that's just how that generation was. You didn't talk about it.
Yeah. And, you know, when I was trying to think about when I was 12 years old, roughly 20 years ago, I'm about 32. You know, I had an uncle with bipolar disorder, and I remember my understanding of bipolar at that time, actually, that it wasn't bipolar disorder. We thought of it as like alcoholism, or we used the word like nervous breakdown quite a bit, just like these weird nebulous terms. Yeah. And so the fact that, you know, your son's age group is actually starting to understand these different kind of conditions and not thinking of them as these scary beasts or anything like that is just so beautiful. It gets me so excited about, you know, the next generation and what the world's going to look like, you know, 20, 30 years from now.
Oh, me too. I'm very excited.
Yeah. So I know about you, of course, because of your Instagram page and your bipolar advocacy. So can you really tell us, I guess, you know, why you started advocating about your bipolar disorder publicly?
Yes, it actually started with my sister. My sister has bipolar, she has bipolar 1, and she was going through the hardest time. She had 3 young children at the time, and she had been in and out of the hospital, I mean, for months, days at a time. She was very manic, just delusional, psychotic. She had, I mean, it happened after the birth of her third child. So I think pregnancy and all that really triggered that for her. But I remember going in there to visit her and, you know, try to comfort her, try to break through to her that, hey, you have bipolar, this is what's going on. And I couldn't stand the fact that when I left, this might sound kind of silly, But I felt like, oh my gosh, the nurses must be making fun of her or something, because my sister was standing on tables. She thought she was a contestant on The Bachelorette. And I thought, why do I feel that way? Why do I think like people are making fun of her? And that was kind of my own, I think, stigma against it.
Inside. Yeah, that's a normal day in the psych ward.
Yeah, so now I know that they, you know, I don't think they were, but in my mind at that time, I thought everyone must be making fun of her, and I don't want my kids or my sister to grow up in a world where I feel like my sister's being made fun of because of something she did not ask for.
Absolutely.
And so I wanted, because she was in denial about it, and so I started this so that we could start the conversation and say, this is not something to be ashamed of. And actually, at times, I mean, I would never say to laugh about it, but you know, now my sister and I can kind of laugh about the time that she thought she was on The Bachelorette, you know, and not make it such a serious, scary thing to talk about. That's what started So Bipolar.
And at that point, when you were helping your sister, oh, hold on, am I hearing an echo? No, okay, it's okay. at that point, when you were helping your sister, did you also have bipolar disorder? Or did you know about it, I guess, at that point?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Yeah. Our bipolars, as you know, everybody's bipolar looks completely different. Mine's, I've never had the extreme manic episode she has. I have more of the hypomania. The doctors think that my kind of more manic stuff that I experienced was a result of my medication, because I did have a lot of med changes over my life, and you could kind of look at them and say, okay, my manic episode started almost immediately after the med change. But I know what those feel like, the manic episodes. But yeah, I'd known, actually, I think before my sister knew that she had bipolar.
Okay. So, and I want to get into, you know, your diagnosis story and kind of where you're at today. But, you know, real quick, I want to talk about kind of that emotion you had of those nurses. Because it's just, I think, I'd like to, I guess, just share my experience, you know, kind of as a med student and just seeing, you know, people who work in the psychiatric realm have just such this level of empathy, I feel like, that they, you know, when they see someone on top of a table saying, I'm the next bachelorette on the rose, I need a rose, God damn it. You know, I feel like they can look at that and yeah, kind of maybe laugh, because it is in a sense kind of funny. There are, you know, some funny stories like that. But look at that individual as sick, you know, and I guess psychotic in a sense, but we just say, oh wow, look, that person's very, very sick. We need to, you know, really use everything that we can, our therapeutic techniques, our medications, and whatever. And why I share this, because in other areas of the hospital, if your sister were to behave that way, it gets perceived very differently. And there is words of like, oh, this is crazy. Like, what is going on? Like, oh my God. And like, and you know, using, oh, this person is just really sick versus, oh, this person is like off the wall, this person is crazy. Like, there is sometimes I've felt kind of different stigma depending on what area, and that's not of course universal, and I think that there are medical staff that are really good at viewing mental illness the way it should be viewed, but I do think that definitely exists. And so that's very interesting, and I see where that kind of emotion kind of came from, you know, when you saw your sister behaving like that. So I'm curious, I saw in one of your blog posts, you know, one of your first real breaks, I think it was right around when you were getting proposed to by your husband, who's also named Logan, which is awesome.
Yes.
And it was right around when you were graduating. I actually had my first manic episode during my undergraduation too. So can you just, I guess, tell us the story of how did you get to a bipolar diagnosis?
Well, at that time I was engaged to Logan, and I was so severely depressed. I mean, I was definitely suicidal at that point. I wrote about it in my journal, and he found it, he read it, and he said, Mary, pack your bags, I'm taking you to a psych hospital. Because what I had written was pretty bad. And I was really, really, I mean, I was, at that time, I was kind of, I think, more in a mixed state of just incredibly irritated at the world, depressed, I mean, beyond depressed. And I didn't want to go, but he's like, we're going. And I trusted him. He's such a good man, and I trusted him. And we got there, and my parents, they only lived 4 hours away. They drove down, And so, you know, it was so scary. I remember just sitting in this cold cement block room, and the doctor there was saying, well, it looks like you're suicidal. And like hearing him say that out loud was just like, I'm like, wow, I've hit rock bottom, you know? And when my parents came, my mom, for one of the first times, I didn't really know, she said, well, I have bipolar. And so Mary must have it as well. And, you know, her mother had it and everything. So they asked me a bunch of questions about, you know, staying up late, feeling like you need to talk so much, that kind of thing. And I thought, what are you even talking about? And he finally came to the conclusion, you have bipolar. And I stayed the night there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so I know your process to kind of like, I guess, getting to a state of wellness, you know, certainly, and I think for everybody, but for you, you've talked about in your blog how it was very challenging. And at some point, you eventually went all the way out to the Mayo Clinic and got genetic testing. So I guess before we talk about genetic testing, like, what did it look like once you left the hospital? How did you start to get your life back together?
So the initial, not the Mayo Clinic, but the hospital where I stayed at, the psychiatric hospital.
Yeah. And just like eventually how you felt so compelled that you needed to go get genetic testing.
Well, so that's a big, long span of my life. Gosh, like 10 or 11 years.
Okay.
But as soon as I left the psychiatric hospital, they got me on some meds that in retrospect made me okay. It was never great. But then, you know, being young, getting married, we wanted to have a family, and really not researching bipolar. I didn't really have a good grasp on what it was. I wasn't too worried about the medications or anything, but they lowered my medications while I was pregnant to what they considered the safest zone. And actually I did phenomenally during my pregnancies. I don't know why, but I did really well, minus the first trimester. I had terrible anxiety, I think because of the withdrawal symptoms, I think from meds, but it was the postpartum that almost killed me each time. It was, okay. Those were really hard. But after my third, where we kind of felt like, okay, we're done having kids, we think, I was really bad after my third, and they were doing so many med changes that it was making me manic. I remember going to my doctor's office, holding my baby in my arms. I could barely hold him. It was one of the side effects of lithium for me. Mm-hmm. I like lost like my muscle control almost. And my husband was out of town. I'm holding my little newborn baby and I'm like, please let me in. Like, please see me. I can't do this. Like, I'm desperate, help me. And of course I didn't get that help that I needed. And so my husband eventually was like, we've got to find something else, especially in smaller towns. It's really hard to find good help sometimes. Yeah. You don't have a ton of options. I had psychiatrists who told me I was having my problems because I led a boring life. And help in the form of counseling and doctors sometimes varies greatly.
Yes. Don't worry, Mary, you can bash psychiatrists on this podcast. No. My reason for going into psychiatry is I had some negative interactions with psychiatrists, you know, and I think that it's okay to talk about things that we don't like about this experience, because hopefully it leads to making it better. So I'm sorry you had to go through that. And yeah, like trying to find psychiatric care anywhere sucks. Trying to find psychiatric care in a rural setting is damn near impossible.
Yeah.
I haven't really woken up until I've had my McDonald's breakfast deal. And I know this is true because before breakfast, I put my phone in the refrigerator and couldn't find the keys that were already in my hand.
Nothing gets the morning going like the first sip of an iced coffee. Get any size and any flavor for 99 cents until 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. McDonald's, I'm loving it.
That's why I'm so excited you're going to be a doctor. And seriously, I've had some incredible doctors. For example, the doctor at Mayo Clinic was amazing and just really gentle and kind. And so, I really don't hope I sound like I'm bashing doctors in general. I just have had a couple bad experiences, just like any profession. Mm-hmm. But so we ended up flying to the Mayo Clinic. I mean, at this point in my life, we had my husband, he's in a very high paced. He's in sales. So we get paid when he makes sales. And so because I was having just breakdowns like all the time, I call him crying, I need you to come home, and he's, you know, 10 hours away. It was very hard to keep money coming in. We were just, our lives were kind of at the bottom of the barrel, so to speak. And we didn't have money at this point, and we were at our wit's end. So we put all our money into flying there, staying there for 2 weeks, paying out of pocket for genetic testing, and because insurance didn't cover it at that time, at least, which kind of blew my mind, because that is ultimately what set me on the path to how I've been doing. I mean, I've been doing wonderfully for the past 3 years since Mayo Clinic, because the genetic testing changed the medication they chose to use on me.
Yeah. Well, okay. Rad. So, yeah, I guess I've used that pharmacogenetic testing a little bit in my experience as a medical student. And I really do think it could be like kind of partially the future of psychiatry in a sense. The clinic I used it at, though, kind of like what you're touching on, was a high-end clinic, let's say. Okay. And, you know, we weren't taking necessarily as much impoverished patients. That's just how this facility was. And I think hopefully that there's some changes in pharmacogenetic testing where, at least in this facility, it would cost the patient, I think, $400 to $500. And then they had like these stipends, not covered by insurance, but through the company themselves, to try to cover the rest of the cost. Because, yeah, it sucks. It's such a expensive endeavor, but it can provide so much valuable information for you and your doctor. So you touched on one of your blog posts, enzyme P450. And so for the listeners, this is an enzyme that's in your liver that metabolizes damn near anything, everything that we use in really all of medicine, not just psychiatry. It's like freaking 70% of meds. Don't quote me on that, but it's a lot. It's crazy. And as a med student, we always have to learn there's certain things that speed up that enzymes. There's certain things that speed them down. So if a person's on two of those medications, it can be very complicated. And so for instance, valproate, the pill I'm on, Depakote, is metabolized by P450. And so it is something that you just have to think about. And in that genetic testing profile, they test a lot of different enzymes, but P450 is definitely one of them. Typically those panels, they're testing different enzymes that metabolize benzos, SSRIs, antidepressants, antipsychotics, and even sometimes pain medication. And it's weird. So when in the role of for me, student doctor, but a psychiatrist or a provider, that you see each medication in three different kind of categories, like, okay, fast metabolizer, normal metabolizer, or slow metabolizer kind of thing. Or sometimes I guess there's a fourth where like, sorry, we don't know. Their body just doesn't work with our testing. But so for instance, like for me, if I were to do this genetic testing, I could find out if my body metabolizes valproate, Depakote, quickly or slower than the normal person, or if I kind of fall in that normal category, normal metabolism speed. So what this can really help with is sometimes a patient can be on a medication and maybe they're a fast metabolizer of that medication. So essentially it's not working because they never have enough of that medication in their system because their body's just running through it so quickly. And the opposite can also be true. So let's imagine I'm a very slow metabolizer of Depakote. We see, therefore, people maybe have a therapeutic effect from valproate, but they have more valproate in their system than they're supposed to because they're a slow metabolizer. And what can lead to that is more side effects. And so for me, maybe that's why I'm a fat, you know, like it could profound some more of the side effects. And then the last thing I kind of want to touch on for this pharmacogenetic testing is one of the most, I think, imperative lessons is, you know, the psychiatrist taught me this pharmacogenetic testing profile is really, really important. But at the end of the day, we always have to listen to our patient. Mm-hmm. If there's a pill on there that it says this is the patient doesn't metabolize this properly, but if the patient says, hey, I feel better when I take this pill, we should still really value what that patient is saying and kind of treat that with the utmost respect and value. So that's my little kind of rant about pharmacogenetic testing. I'd love to kind of hear what your experience was and how this helped you find a better medication regimen that worked for you.
Yes, well, I had a couple thoughts while you were talking on this. Very interesting the way you explained it. One of the best explanations I've heard. Because it, to people who don't understand medicine and all this, it's kind of confusing. So my one question for you is, so I was taking the medications I take, I'm so sensitive that I've had to have my medication sometimes especially compounded to really, really small amounts. So that would that
Okay.
I'm like a slow metabolizer for
Yeah, I mean, I would of course want to see the exact test, but if they're saying, "Hey, Mary, we want to reduce the dose of this," it's possible, yeah, that those categories of medicines are in the slow metabolism category. So therefore, they can use less medication to get you to a therapeutic dose, meaning a dose that actually provides benefit in your life. And especially, if you had too much of that medicine around before when you were taking a higher dose, maybe that's why you were suffering some of the side effects that you didn't like.
Yeah, because the tiniest change and it just it would completely change everything for me. It was pretty crazy.
Okay. And did they make one change kind of right away, or was this a series of changes over the course of like 12 months kind of thing before you found something you liked?
Oh, right after Mayo Clinic, it was I had been tapering off other medications, but as soon as they added this, it was Effexor, added that in and it changed everything for me almost immediately within a few weeks. And I never had to go up. I've been on the same dose for 3 years and I've been great. So.
Wonderful. So yeah, I hope like pharmacogenetic testing kind of works its way into really all clinics of psychiatry, even family medicine practices.
So actually, I'm so excited because I did a talk with one of the leading pharmacogenetic companies in the world, and they said that that is the future, that they are pushing to get this readily available to everyone, where it's not just, I mean, they're like working on it right now. So I was very, very encouraged by that.
And hopefully no listeners are thinking this genetic test is some crazy invasive procedure where they take out a piece of your brain or something. To my understanding, I don't know if you did anything different. They just took a swab inside your mouth.
Yep, super easy. Yeah.
So hopefully insurance, will start picking this up. Now we live in under a total different federal government, so maybe health insurance will change radically over the next few years anyway. So who knows? But I do really I agree with you. I hope it's certainly covered because I think it can provide a lot of value to patients. And one of my reasons for going into psychiatry, I heard so many different stories of people who struggled to find medications they liked for sounded like your experience for years. I got very lucky. My experience was about a year to find something that worked for me. But yeah, that's where I'm at. So I'd like to ask you kind of, I guess one project that I saw that you really did that I thought was so cool was using photography to express different symptoms of bipolar disorder. Can you talk about that advocacy project you did?
Yeah, that was actually right when I started my Instagram and blog account. I just wanted to visually, without reading or anything, for other people who had bipolar to look at those images and see themselves in it, because I didn't want them to feel alone. And that was what I felt when I got my bipolar diagnosis was, well, nobody else I know has this. I mean, yeah, I had my mom who I didn't know, but literally, and honestly, to this day in real life, not on my blog, I've never met anybody who, except maybe one or two people who said it after I said, oh, I have bipolar. I've never met anybody who I know who quote unquote admits to having bipolar. It's not talked about. And I want people to start talking about it so that we don't all feel alone, because there are so many of us.
And
But
sometimes it's hard, I feel like, to put symptoms of bipolar disorder into words. And I really liked And I'll of course share this, you know, when on my Instagram, when I post our episode, but like, you know, expressing like kind of rage, you know, in the photograph of you yelling and how you kind of put these two different symptoms of like mania and depression next to each other with two different photographs. You talk about like kind of hypersexuality of bipolar disorder. I think it's just all these really cool concepts that are very awkward and sometimes challenging to articulate into words. And the fact that you use art and visual photography like that is great. Do you ever see yourself doing more visual photography artwork like that, I guess, for advocacy?
You know, I should, and I would love to do more of that. I'm kind of at a season in my life, I guess you could say, where my advocacy, I've kind of put it a little bit on the back burner. I have really young, or not so little kids anymore, but they're needing a lot more mom time. Mm-hmm. And I'm also working on a project that's outside of my blog for mental health. I'm going to be starting a business that's going to be taking the profits and donating towards mental health initiatives. So I think in the future I will, but just not right at this moment.
Okay. Yeah, I hope you do, because I think you have a talent for it. I really enjoyed those photographs. I think it was just really a powerful way to try to articulate kind of, you know, what we go through. So one thing I also want to chat about with you is, you know, one element of your advocacy that I think is also really powerful is you talk about kind of losses in your life, you know, most notably your 16-year-old nephew and your friend who both died because of suicide. And I'm very sorry for those losses in your life. And, you know, if you feel comfortable, I'd love to hear, you know, those stories of both of those people in your life and really what they taught you about how you want to move forward with this and how we can improve as a mental health industry.
Right. So I lost my 16-year-old nephew the end of April last year. So that was right after COVID had kind of started. He'd been in the house for, I mean, that was when everyone was really, really quarantined, like didn't leave the house at all. The schools were shut down, no sports. So my nephew, oh my gosh, this kid was brilliant beyond brilliant. Athletic, handsome. I mean, he just was like this ball of a perfect nephew I could ever ask for. But he also had bipolar and he had been struggling with it. And I talked to him so many times. We did this fun thing where we'd text each other 10 things we were grateful for that day. And we did that for a month. I mean, we did all these things to try and keep our minds positive during the quarantine and everything. But ultimately, and he said it in his suicide letter that, you know, the COVID lockdown shutdowns were kind of the straw that broke this camel's back, is what he said. Because, and the way I've been comparing it to people is because there's still a lot of schools who are shut down. And I just read an article today that a school district in Las Vegas is trying to push to get kids back in school despite the climbing numbers of COVID, because they've had 18 suicides amongst, which is double what they had back in 2019 and 2019's entirety.
Yeah.
So, I mean, these kids are just suffering so much. I mean, I compare it to if we all had, a pain in our ankle and COVID to me is like, okay, well, let's just have somebody step on your ankle for the next 12 months and see how you feel at the end. I feel like it's really making these mental health problems worse in the kids. Well, I guess everyone. I mean, I've been seeing an uptick in adults even messaging me saying, you know, this COVID is really hard. He was being medicated. He had been to a psychiatric hospital and he hated it, which was also my experience. Some people have really great experiences with their hospitals, some do not. I think my nephew didn't have the best of ones, and they put him on medication. And I mean, this isn't a fact at all, but I think he was like me. I later found out the medications they put him on, and they were the ones that made me manic. And so I'm wondering if it possibly made him worse and gave him suicidal thoughts. And so I'll never forget the day when we got the call that they couldn't find my nephew. And eventually the cops found him by a river. So that was really hard. It's been very hard on my entire family. He was just an incredible, incredible kid. But then a couple weeks later, a friend who I had also been on the phone with for, he didn't live in the same state as me, but I'd been talking to him for the past like almost 2 years on the phone about his journey with bipolar and how difficult it was. He had to quit his job and he couldn't provide for his family and all of this stuff. And got the call a couple weeks later after my nephew Christian died that he also had taken his life. So it was a rough go. And honestly, since then I have, within my own community, we've also buried other young kids, and we keep getting notifications of more and more young kids, especially taking their lives. So it's kind of, in my own mind, the pandemic that's also happening during all this COVID that's just not getting as much attention as it needs to.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, you posted a video, I believe it was from your nephew's service. That was, I believe, just so powerful. And, you know, and some things I think that you talked about that really resonated with me that I want to make sure the listeners, you know, value as well is, you know, your nephew died because of bipolar disorder. This wasn't a cowardly act or a selfish act. And in many ways, I don't even really think it was his decision in a sense. It was, you know, his disorder got so severe, and it's very unfortunate in the world of psychiatry. Sometimes the things we do help, and definitely sometimes the meds we use make things worse. And one of the Black Box warnings, especially on certain meds, like a lot of antidepressants, is especially for adolescents, it can increase thoughts of suicide. And it's very odd to think about that we use a medication that's supposed to help people with depression, but can potentially cause more suicidal thoughts, especially in adolescents. It's extremely scary, and I cannot even imagine the amount of pain that your family is going through. And yeah, I have very mixed feelings about COVID shutting down schools. Mixed feelings, I think, is just kind of the best way to put it. I you know, I've done some child and adolescent work in my short time as a med student, and it's just, you see the tremendous impact of this social isolation. And you know, these students obviously aren't learning as effectively as they used to. It's just such an unfortunate situation for so many ways. And I think that kids are resilient and fragile at the same time. And it's just so unfortunate that the mental health system failed your nephew and your friend, of course. And it's just terrible. So another thing I really wanted to ask you about is one of your posts that I really, really liked. And I guess one way that we're going to both try to improve this mental health system is by continuing to advocate and be open and honest. But one thing that I've experienced is when I say, I have bipolar disorder, yada, yada. You're so brave. Oh, thank you. You're so brave. And I saw you had a post. I forget exactly what it says, but like, you're not brave for saying like, oh, I have a colon cancer or I have a broken ankle. Like, you know, this is just something that I deal with. I have to deal with because it's a disorder. So yeah, I guess what led you to make that post, and what do you feel about, like, you know, oh, you're so brave by saying that?
Well, even though I know that when people say, oh, you're so brave for saying this to people that you have bipolar, I understand they're being kind and supportive. So I'm not bad mouthing them. However, I think that language is so powerful. And when you say that someone's brave for saying something, that's saying that there's something that they should be ashamed of. It's like kind of the underlying message. And in no other illness or disorder do you say, oh, you're so brave. I mean, there really isn't. You don't say, oh, you're brave for telling me you have cancer. No, mm-hmm. You say you're brave for fighting cancer. Like, you're courageous, you're strong. Like, that's what you say to people with cancer. And I don't think we can get rid of stigma if we're still telling people they're brave for it. And I got kind of not a lot, but I did get backlash on that post that I made, because a lot of people said, well, no, like, we are brave for saying that. And yes, at this moment in time, it's brave in that there is stigma and people don't accept what am I trying to say? It's just still looked at in a bad light. And so we have a ways to go before people don't think that it's brave, but it shouldn't be brave to say it, just like any other illness. And so, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and it's something that I feel very passionate about, because I like what you said. You know, I think people, when they say, oh, you're so brave, they're in a sense trying to be like, give you a compliment, and they come, I think, from a good place. But it definitely also perpetuates the stigma in my eyes. You know, it's like, well, you're implying that that you need to be brave to live in this space, to be open about your mental illness. And, you know, I think in some ways it's analogous to telling someone who maybe is not traditional heterosexual, like, oh, you're brave for being open about your homosexuality. It's like, well, why do you need to be brave? Like, can't we live in a world that's open and accepting of people who have non-traditional sexual preferences? Can't we be open about this world where we are honest that we have mental conditions, the same way that people have problems with their teeth or with their heart or with their, you know, gut? It's I just try to view the brain as no different than any other organ. And yeah, why do I need to be brave to try to treat an illness associated with that? It makes me mad, because I always just try to go, yeah, you know, I made this decision not as a brave decision. I made it as an open decision. I guess, though, I should articulate, when I first started my advocacy efforts for bipolar disorder, I thought I had to be brave. And I thought it was going to take this tremendous amount of courage. But in my experiences, and I'd love to hear yours as well, you know, 99% of the time, my experiences with people and conversations about my mental health and anything related to mental health are extremely positive. Yes, there is that 1% of time that has some negative stigma stuff I don't like. But I think if you anticipate that that exists, you can focus on the 99% much more. What has your experience been?
I didn't realize you liked me that way, deal. Because it's one thing to receive McDonald's, but an entirely other thing to know that they woke up early to face the world and bring you McDonald's breakfast still hot in the bag.
Appreciate you.
There's a deal for every morning. Now grab 2 loaded sausage burritos for only $3. Prices and participation may vary. Single item at regular price. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more.
Wait a minute. I've heard that before. That's the note Jeremy wrote to me in my yearbook in the 6th grade. How'd you even know that?
Because it's from Geico.
Yeah, wait, here it is. Dear Luke, have a great summer. P.S. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more. Love, Jeremy.
Geico's had this tagline for years, because we help save people money.
So wait, you're saying Jeremy copied you? Yeah, that actually does sound like something the J-Man would do.
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more.
Oh, I completely agree with you. Yes, I've had those 1% of people who have said really nasty, negative things about me. But as a whole, I am so glad that I chose to share my experience, because I felt nothing but love and support from so many people, which again is encouraging that the stigma is, you know, going away. But I think the stigma, a lot of it is an internal stigma too, that we just need to work on ourselves too. But I think that's just going to come over time with more talking about our experiences. But it's been nothing. I mean, it really, really has been so positive. I have a lot of people who say, you know, I want to tell my family I had this. I want to tell my friends, but I'm too scared to. I'm like, well, what are you scared of? You have to ask yourself what you're scared of. And when I first did it, my fear, what I pinpointed it down to, was I don't care that people know this about me, because if you don't want to hang out with me because I have bipolar, you're lost, you know, fine. My concern was I have 3 kids. And I want them to have play dates over at my house. And for, you know, I was worried that it was going to hurt them socially. Mm-hmm. Because their mothers would be like, oh, well, she has bipolar. Why would we let, you know, Johnny go over to their house? That was like what was going through my mind. But again, I came to the conclusion that, okay, if I have a parent who doesn't want Johnny to come over to my house because I was diagnosed with bipolar, I don't want Johnny to come over anyways, because Johnny's parents are probably overly protective and all this stuff. But I mean, all my kids' friends, for the most part, know that I have this diagnosis, and I'm like best friends with them. They're just absolutely fantastic. And it's been such a blessing to see the love people actually have, like, that I didn't know was out there, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And I think because everyone has some element of mental illness in their family. There's, I mean, one in four people suffer with mental illness. So basically someone in your immediate family, and if not immediate family, extended family, has mental illness. Mm-hmm. And so I think everyone can kind of relate. And I feel like when I shared that I have bipolar disorder, like, people almost let their guard down. It's like, oh shit, like, I can talk about like my own like kind of problems. And you know, it's pretty cool to hear you talk about your children. I don't have kids yet. I would like to one day. But what motivated me is I know when I do have kids, statistically, there's a good chance, or there's a higher chance, that they could have bipolar disorder. You know, they're going to have half of my genetic profile. And I want to live in a world where they can just deal with it and not feel ashamed of it. And, you know, I consider myself very lucky for getting psychiatric care when I did, and lucky for the family and friends that I've had around me this whole time. And I just want to make sure that they have as good of a chance, or much, much better, you know, to deal with symptoms of bipolar disorder that they definitely could face.
Yes, that's beautiful. That's exactly what I hope for this whole next generation, is that they have it an even easier time than we did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've taken up about 40 minutes of your time now. You know, I want to shift this end of the conversation to, you know, let's imagine there's, I guess, someone out there who, this episode's a lot about bipolar disorder, who has bipolar disorder, who's struggling. Maybe they're thinking about disclosing, or maybe they're just having a really lame, shitty day. What advice would you give them?
Gosh, the best piece of advice I have for people struggling at this moment is that I always kind of replay in my mind, is that you are one choice away from a completely different life. And I mean that in that when I was struggling, it was always, okay, that didn't work, so let's make another choice to see what does work. You keep making choices, the best choice that you can, that's right in front of you, and it does lead to a completely different life. When I was at Mayo Clinic, one of the ladies drew a picture, so, of like a boat, okay? And so, you know how they have like that line, what is it called? Sorry, I can't remember the name of it, but they slightly move the arrow of where the boat's supposed to go. So it's supposed to go straight, but then you slightly move that dial, that little arrow, to go in a slightly different direction, and you end up in a completely different spot. So it's just like that tiny little change you make in your life that really does have a huge impact. So I remember like sitting there just crying in my bed, not being able to get out of my bed. I was so depressed at one point, and just feeling like, oh, I just want it to change tomorrow. But knowing, no, if I just make one choice today, that's going to lead to another, it's going to lead to another, and eventually I'm going to be in a completely different place. And I'm a living testimony to that, because I can tell you that I was in the worst of the worst spots you could imagine. And I, like I said, I've been doing phenomenally and have been living just an absolutely joy-filled life, which is another thing that I'd like to say, is that with bipolar, I feel like a lot of times when we get that diagnosis, it feels like a death sentence. Like, oh, I am like, let's say you're a doctor, a lawyer, or some other higher profile type job. A lot of people will get that diagnosis and be like, oh dear gosh, I can't tell anybody. I cannot tell anybody because I will not have any patients. I won't have any clients. They won't trust me, which is just, I hear this a lot from people. So this does happen, which is why when you told me that you were becoming a doctor soon and you have bipolar, like, that excited me so much, because I'm like, finally, somebody who's a doctor who's saying I have bipolar, and it's nothing to be ashamed of. So most people would say, okay, well, people aren't going to trust me because I have bipolar and I might be manic or depressed or something. But the thing is I think you're going to be 10 times more popular because you have bipolar, because you know what it's like. I mean, I would be your first patient if I lived near you. I'm very excited.
Because thank you.
It takes somebody who has been through the ringer to know the compassion, and to somebody who you feel like you can trust and say, look, I'm feeling this way, and not have them tell you like what my doctors have sometimes told me, oh, it's all in your head. You know, somebody who gets it. So, and unfortunately that shows us that we still have a lot of work to do with stigma, because a lot of people will not say anything to anybody for fear they will never have a job again. Mm-hmm. And personally, I don't know. I currently don't work in the traditional sense. Like, I don't have a 9-to-5 job. I've been mainly a stay-at-home mom. That's just something my husband and I have always wanted, but I don't know. Like, if I go to get a job and I have my face all over the internet for bipolar, it would be interesting to see how many callbacks I got. I don't know.
It's tough to say, you know, and like, for instance, I had the same kind of feelings. I applied to all these different psychiatry residencies. I wonder if some immediately when they read, oh, this kid has bipolar, no way in hell are we interviewing him. And it's so funny to hear you bring up, you know, I think valid kind of negative associations of being disclosing of mental illness. Oh, maybe this doctor won't be as qualified, as good. Maybe he'll be, I'll catch him on a day where he's manic or depressed. And, you know, I just had my last psychiatry residency interview yesterday. Hopefully my last one. Hopefully I batch. And I get this question. And they're like, so what are you going to do if a patient knows you have bipolar disorder? And they come to your appointment and they're not cool with that. And I'm like, if they feel that way, do you realistically think they would come? Like, no, like patients miss psychiatry appointments all the time. And I kind of almost view my style as, in a sense, one day going to be self-selecting for patients who actually, like you, value my experiences and how maybe I have a different approach to medicine than other psychiatrists. And that kind of being said, you know, what I've learned, and I of course don't really know anyone individually, but I know that they're out there. There's a lot of other doctors who live with mental illness. Whether they share that experience or not is a different conversation. Because for professional licensing, I am anticipating that I'm going to have to jump through additional hoops, maybe additional interviews, drug testing, I don't know. But I'm kind of anticipating that by me checking that box on that, when you fill out your license, you have to fill out all this like health questionnaire and have you ever been arrested? Have you ever been in drug treatment? Have you ever been mental illness? Blah, 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 yeah. And I don't want to lie on those forms, but I know that by being honest, I'm going to have to go through extra hoops. And so what a lot of doctors do, and it's really lame, but they quite frankly don't put yes on those forms. And then they'll treat their mental illness outside with a psychiatrist that doesn't use an electronic medical health record because they're afraid to have that their record is on some database and that it could potentially jeopardize their career. So yeah, that's my little rant, you know, and hopefully it changes for the better. And that's why I and you do the things we do. So Mary, you know, I've taken up a lot of your time and I've interviewed you. Do you have any questions for me?
Oh gosh, I know I have a lot. let's see. Like as far as like on the horizon comes, like we were talking about genetic testing. Do you see anything from like schooling that you see is going to change the way really psychiatry is practiced or anything, or like any big improvements, so to speak, on the horizon? Or
yeah, I mean, I just think psychiatry is open to new ideas. Whether how effective those new ideas are going to be is a different conversation, but you know, I feel that there's, for instance, like depression, you know, there's a lot of people don't really know about TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation therapy. And, you know, I encourage anyone to really look and to see if they're a good candidate for TMS therapy, if they're suffering, especially with like depression or anxiety. because people are afraid of like ECT getting, you know, shocked. But TMS is like this little machine that creates this magnetic field around your brain and can kind of stimulate a bunch of neurotransmitters to be released. Very analogous to ECT treatment, but you don't get sedated. It doesn't have as much memory loss as you like watch YouTube and Netflix while it's going on. I'm sure you've also heard like ketamine recently was approved to treat depression, and it's happening, but it's not certainly like a popular treatment modality. It's not always covered by insurance either. And the
sorry to interrupt you on that, but with the TMS and the ketamine, those two are not effective for bipolar. Is that correct? Can't if you have bipolar, like it's not a good idea. I felt like I read that somewhere. Maybe not.
For TMS, at least the indication is that it's not, because it releases potentially anyone who's had psychotic features should not really. Well, it's there's never any hard lines, you know, in science and medicine. You could always make an argument, well, we could try it and just kind of see how it goes, but there's risks with everything. And people with any kind of psychotic features where in mania, you know, we don't know if what's real and what's not, schizophrenia, hearing voices kind of thing, hallucinations, they think that TMS potentially can elicit those psychotic features. But I really think that a lot of additional science needs to be had before we as psychiatrists can definitively say, no, bipolar patients should never, ever take this. And, you know, it's very interesting you say that, because it's like, you know, me and you both identify with having a bipolar disorder. I think we would agree with bipolar disorder. But there is no genetic test that specifically can prove that we have genetic or bipolar disorder. No blood test, no brain scan. It doesn't exist. And so it's like, yeah, maybe someone with bipolar disorder could benefit from TMS, and maybe that wasn't the right diagnosis for them. You know, so it becomes very nebulous. It's like, maybe. Did you have another question?
15 minutes could save you 15% or more.
Wait a minute. I've heard that before. That's the note Jeremy wrote to me in my yearbook in the sixth grade. How'd you even know that?
Because it's from Geico.
Yeah, wait, here it is. Dear Luke, have a great summer. P.S. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more. Love, Jeremy.
Geico's had this tagline for years, because we help save people money.
So wait, you're saying Jeremy copied you? Yeah, that actually does sound like something the J-Man would do.
Geico, 15 minutes could save you 15% or more.
It's a comment/question, I guess. One thing that I've been really discouraged with as a whole with, I guess, the field of psychiatry, if you want to call it that, is that I felt many times like when I went to my doctor, I would say, you know, like mentally, yes, I know I'm depressed, but I also have hormones. I also have spirituality. I also have like all these things. And the comment that I was told a couple of times by a doctor was, well, I only work in psychiatry. Like I only work with the mind and meds of the mind and stuff. And I'm like, well, maybe I just look at things differently, but I think it all works as a whole together. Do you see the future of psychiatry going more towards, hey, let's look at the person's spirituality, their environment, their home life, all of that, and really bring it together? Look at their hormones, being able to like, because hormones, I think, have a big impact on, I mean, the little science that I know about it with our gut health and how our hormones are produced in our guts. And that's also where like our serotonin is produced, mm-hmm. and all that it's all very complex and all really works together. That I felt many times like I was going to this doctor, and trying to put it all together myself. And then I got myself into a mess because this doctor wants to put me on this and this doctor saying, no, don't do that. And I just felt like I was having to like overly advocate for myself because I was trying to put it all together and nobody could do it for me. Does that make sense?
Very much so. And I that sucks you had to go through that. And yeah, I would say you had a shitty psychiatrist, 100%. Because I just think that's such a poor way to look at things. And, you know, I wouldn't even say it's the future of psychiatry, because that's how proper psychiatry should be practiced and has been practiced. And, you know, so I'm studying to be a DO physician, which kind of means osteopathy and kind of like how the body is interrelated. But my MD colleagues, and they take I took the same board test they take. You know, it's not like their training is radically different. You know, they, that psychiatrist that said that, I kind of want to slap in the head. You know, like, if that's how you think as a psychiatrist, did you forget that we have to go through medical school and then do an intern year and get a lot of the same training as other doctors? You know, the first arguably 4.5 years, meaning 4 years of med school and then your half year of your intern year, is more or less the same for every single doctor that they go through, whether it's a neurosurgeon, your OBGYN, or a psychiatrist. We have to fulfill the certain criteria. So yeah, the fact that that psychiatrist says that, oh, I only use meds that treat the mind, like, no shit. But, like, you know, everyone, like, the body is interrelated. You're telling me that a woman's menstrual cycle does not affect her moods? Or, yeah, you know, there is actually a lot of new technology and understanding around potentially gut health. There's a big understanding of a correlation between irritable bowel syndrome and anxiety disorders. Mm-hmm. And tons of people with anxiety go through all these extensive testing where they stick cameras down their throat and in their butt to find nothing. And it's you know, so it really pisses me off to hear that you had that experience with that doctor. That is not the kind of practice of psychiatry that I'm going to be looking forward to. Okay. So yeah, I hope it's not the future of psychiatry, because I hope it's already here. But definitely elements of bad psychiatrists exist. So yeah, that's terrible that you had to deal with that. And it's so unfortunate. Yeah, like, patients have to be their own advocates so much in this process. And I remember one time I was having some side effects very initially when I was first diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and I was taking a medication that made me, it was inability to sit still, akinesia, or restless leg syndrome. Yeah.
I had that too. That's okay. Horrible.
Yeah. And I remember feeling embarrassed to tell my psychiatrist this, because I thought he would make me go back to the psych ward. And, wow. You know, it was now in my seat where I am now as, you know, almost a doctor, I'm like, well, that was dumb. But that's how I felt in the moment. I didn't understand the psychiatry system and how to navigate this weird space. So yeah, I'm sorry you had to deal with that, Mary, but hopefully, you know, you could find someone a little bit more appropriate to your style and needs.
Oh yeah, I found somebody. This was in the past. Okay. So yeah, but gosh, all the more just listening to you talk, I just felt so excited, because again, when you have your patients, you can say, look, nothing you can tell me is, like, off the wall. I've been there. I know what it feels like. And, like, what better doctor could you possibly have than somebody who makes you feel that comfortable? Because that's one of the big problems with when you're diagnosed, is you feel so uncomfortable all the time and almost paranoid of, like, no, please don't send me back to the psych hospital, please. I don't want to go. So a lot of people withhold that information, but when they feel comfortable enough to have that easygoing conversation, I just think that that's going to be incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. What else can I answer for you?
Well, when were you diagnosed again? How old were you?
So it's funny you ask. You know, this May and this graduation from medical school is going to be very special for me. It will be 10 years since I was manic and had a diagnosis. And I was diagnosed with mania, or manic depression. I wish it was still called manic depression. I don't like the word bipolar. I think manic depression's way cooler. I like Jimi Hendrix.
You know, I do too. I like it better.
But it was when I graduated undergraduate school in 2011. And so, you know, this May, it will be 10 years.
Oh, how cool. That is awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. Very cool. So we were kind of around the same age diagnosed.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Well, Mary, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. One post I saw you make, and I'm going to do this afternoon, is I think one of the best therapeutic modalities that you can do for your mental health is cleaning and decluttering. And it sounds so stupid, but it's, you know, you're kind of exercising, moving around, but also, like, living in a space that is clean, I feel like it allows you to have such a better focus and more calming experience. So that's kind of my afternoon. I have some classes to attend to, but also cleaning and try to benefit my mental health today. What are you trying to do today for your mental health?
I love it. I'm kind of doing something similar. We moved recently, and so I'm kind of situating furniture and all that kind of stuff, but I'm also going to go work out here after we're done. So working out keeps me sane. I love working out. So
what does working out look like for you?
For the last 10 years of my life, I've wanted my own Pilates reformer, but they're so dang expensive that it's taken me like 10 years to save up for one, but I finally have one. So I will be using that.
I don't even know what this is. A Pilates reform. I thought a Pilates was just a mat.
Well, it can be, but there's, look it up on the internet. You sit on a carriage and there's a foot bar and springs and resistance, and you can basically work out any muscle in your body in thousands.
Oh, I am looking at this thing. You know, it's funny. I actually used one of those at physical therapy for my knee.
The inventor of Pilates, his name was Joseph Pilates, and he invented it basically for the rehabilitation of soldiers. So it's very easy on your joints and breath work. You have to breathe a lot in it, and that helps me breathing. I have to remind myself to breathe. Because I've had anxiety kind of my whole life. And so I kind of help keep that at bay with breath work with Pilates. So.
Well, rad. Well, I've taken up about an hour of your Tuesday here. It's been such a pleasure talking to you. I hope you want to come back on the show. I definitely would love to have you back on and hear, kind of about how advocacy is looking different at different stages of your life. You know, I imagine being a mother of three kids who are young is overwhelming. And I have pets and I feel overwhelmed. So, kudos to you. And please, come back on the show. And it was great talking to you.
Well, thank you, Logan. And I'd love to.
All right.
I haven't really woken up until I've had my McDonald's breakfast deal. And I know this is true because before breakfast, I put my phone in the refrigerator and couldn't find the keys that were already in my hand.
Nothing gets the morning going like the first sip of an iced coffee. Get any size and any flavor for 99 cents until 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. McDonald's, I'm loving it.
Finding the right person for the job isn't easy. Just ask someone who hired their personal trainer as a caterer.
All right, folks, let's keep this line moving. You there with the tongs, picking up one Duchess potato at a time will not cut it at my catering table. Drop and give me 50.
But if you've got an insurance question, you can always count on your local GEICO agent. They can bundle your policies, which could save you hundreds.
Okay, this is what we call the wild mushroom and asparagus dip, dip, and press. Come on, let's get those plates above your heads.
For expert help with all your insurance needs, visit geico.com/local today.